Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
Hi, hi, hi.
Hi. It's our first full-length episode of the year.
Yep.
Of 2020.
2020.
Oh, God. I'm a million years old. I feel so old.
Fucking wild.
So we decided to open the year up with doing a forgotten favorite.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Those are our... At least they're my favorites to do.
Well, and
for the most part,
it made it kind of easy for us because
coming
out
of the holidays.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I was on a full like island for the entire week between Christmas and New Year's. I didn't do shit. I watched like all the Harry Potter movies. I watched like all the Star Wars movies.
Yeah, I had my mom in town. I had friends that visited. I was not living in a normal world. I haven't worked in almost 2 weeks. It's been weird, and I gotta tell you, though, I had a really hard time picking someone. I did almost 4 complete research on 4 different people.
Why'd you keep changing your mind?
I didn't, because there either wasn't enough information, or I wasn't feeling it. A lot of it was a lack of information. Like, there was someone that I was gonna do who I still want to do in the future, but I think it needs more time because mm-hmm. it's very recent. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of information about them.
That can become difficult. Like, when you're choosing a forgotten feminist favorite, like, the whole point is that a lot of people haven't, like, heard
yes.
about them. So sometimes you can find yourself in a predicament where there's not a whole lot of information.
Yes. Like, my person is not forgotten. The name is actually probably one of the most notable names in feminism.
Okay.
But there's a lot of information about the person because they've been in it for so long mm-hmm. that we don't, maybe it's not at the forefront of our minds. And I wanted to learn more about this person.
Sounds
so
good.
I'm not going first, but you'll find out
okay,
a little bit.
Great.
But I was very interested in learning more about this person. So I want to know who you're talking about this week, Keegan.
Okay. So I kind of had the opposite situation as
Girl,
you.
Like, send me some information then.
Well, no. I mean, a lot of times I really struggle with who to pick, and
yeah.
it takes me a really long time to decide. And this time I kind of was like, you know what? I'm just going to pick somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do a little bit of reading. And so I pulled up a Marie Claire article that had, like, you know, I don't know, 20 different feminists on it. And I did, like, each, you know, each one had a paragraph. And so I
yeah.
went and I read through
That's
all of them.
That's usually what
I need to. And I found one that I was just like, okay, I like this person. Let's go. And then that was it. I was like, I'm going to do it on that
Ugh,
person.
Jealous. So who? I want to know. Because maybe I thought of this person, too.
I am going to be talking about Pauli Murray, who I am shocked that I didn't know about. Like, I'm actually very, very surprised.
Pauli?
Pauli, like P-A-U-L-I, not Pauli, like P-O-L-L-Y.
Right. Pauli Murray.
Murray, yes.
I don't know this person at
okay.
all.
So she was born Anna Pauline Murray on November 20th, 1910 in Baltimore, Maryland. And her mother was Agnes Murray. And she died of a cerebral hemorrhage when Pauli was only 4 years old.
Oh, no.
So... Yeah, like already, I mean, she was essentially orphaned because right after that, her father, William, who was a popular English teacher at a local high school, he came down with typhoid fever, and it was only, I think, maybe a year or so, like after her mother's death, did he get sick. And then as a result of the typhoid, he ended up having like long-term consequences from it because he'd had typhoid fever for a couple of years. When he first came down with it, they went ahead and sent Pauli and her siblings to various relatives throughout the country. So
that's so sad.
It's very
and what,
sad.
Remind me what year this is again.
So she was born in 1910. So I think around like 1915.
Yeah.
They sent her to go live with her aunt Pauline.
Okay.
And her grandparents in North Carolina. So after the kids were sent away, her father continued to get like sicker and sicker. And even though he mostly recovered from typhoid fever, it ended up doing damage. I don't know how it works, but it did damage to him mentally.
I think it's also just like if you have a fever in general for a certain amount of time, that can affect you. But then, yeah, I think that there are certain illnesses where it'll have lingering effects because it's something attacking your body. And if it's that way for so long, I can see where there would be...
Yeah, it had psychological effects on him. So he ended up having mental and emotional problems.
Oh, dear.
And he was sent to the psychiatric wing of Crownsville State Hospital, which was also called the Hospital for the Negro Insane of Maryland.
Mm.
So both of her parents identified as black. And so her father was confined to this basically mental institution for black people.
I have a feeling he wasn't treated very well.
He was not treated very well. In fact, he was murdered by a white guard in 1923.
Stop.
When he was beat to death.
Oh my God.
Pauline was 13 at the time, and she had hoped whenever she grew up that she could take custody of her dad and take care of him.
And like have a relationship with him in some way. Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, she never got the chance because he passed away when she was 13.
That is something we should talk about during Mental Health Awareness Month is the history of like psych wards, mental hospitals, the treatment of patients. Yeah. My friend was in a hospital a few years ago. And she, you know, brought herself in. But then as soon as she was in, she was like, oh, my God, get me the fuck out. Like, these people. Mm-hmm. It was crazy.
And it can be difficult to get yourself out, too. Once you're in, it can be hard to get yourself out. And it would be especially interesting. I wasn't trying to focus on this, and I already have, like, 6 pages of notes. So I didn't want to spend too long looking at it. But there is a Wikipedia page for Crownsville State Hospital. And the history of it is interesting because I think it was erected, I mean, this is the early 1900s, and I think it was erected in, like, the late 1800s, whenever they decided, like, hey, you know, black people can be mentally, ill as well, and, like, what do we do with these people?
Because you know can't what I mean? Put them with white people.
That no, would just they be, have to have their own...
Can't do that.
You know, psychiatric hospital. So that's whenever they created this hospital. So I bet you the history is really fascinating and probably
it's haunted,
really sad.
Haunted as fuck, too. That, we're totally gonna... That is so fascinating to me. I was never in a hospital, but I know a lot of people who were. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough that I was in kind of like homes that had medical care and things like that, so it's a little bit different, but...
But it's really sad because, you know, this man was a very popular, well-liked English teacher.
Yeah.
He was kind of like, he went to Howard University.
And he got sick.
Mm-hmm, and it made him ill. It's not like, you know, so...
And then he got killed.
Yeah, and then he got killed. So poor Polly at this point.
Polly.
She is 13 and now officially orphaned.
Oh, gosh.
But she's been living with her Aunt Pauline and her grandparents.
Right.
Basically from the time she was like 5 or so.
So at least she has, hopefully, positive support from her family.
She does.
Okay,
so
good.
Her Aunt Pauline was a school teacher, and she often took young Polly with her to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so Polly began reading books and studying subjects that were far advanced for her grade level wise.
Mm-hmm.
So she was like really smart and really studious and wanted to learn.
Yeah.
And so not only was her father a teacher, but her aunt Pauline, and then she had another aunt who also lived in that area in North Carolina, and they were both teachers as well. So Polly lived in Durham, North Carolina until 1926, when at the age of 16, she graduated from Hillside High School in North Carolina, and then decided to move to New York, where she would attend a second high school in order to meet the entrance requirements for college.
Interesting. So in North Carolina, you could graduate at 16, but then if you wanted to live elsewhere or go to college, you had to go elsewhere?
I'm guessing it was the level of education that she got at the high school in North Carolina. Like, maybe it didn't meet the credit requirements for college. So she went to New York.
By herself at 16?
By herself.
Damn, girl.
But she went to live with a cousin named Maud. So.
Okay. I love that name.
Maud. I know. I love old names. I think
me too.
They're really fun. So even though Polly's parents identified as black, she had kind of a complicated mixed race background, like more distantly.
Okay.
So her parents looked black. She looks obviously mixed race. You can tell that she's black. But her cousin Maud and her entire family were white passing.
Oh.
So they were mixed race, but they were white passing and they were living in a white neighborhood, which made it difficult for Polly to be there.
It is New York, which I think has always been, you know, it was in the North. It's not like living in the South where it's probably different, but still, if you're living in a white neighborhood in New York, that kind of goes with the implications of like,
it's a different kind of racism. Like,
it's like a superiority kind of thing.
It's a more subtle form of racism, but it still like very much exists.
It totally does.
Yeah.
I can see, you know, I think of like the Hamptons, like white people, mm-hmm. and just the strong divide between the races at the time.
Right. And we're talking 1927.
Exactly.
So it's definitely very divided.
Civil rights.
Yeah, everything. Absolutely. Yeah. It's completely before any of that was going on. And so more than anything, I think that she just made their neighbors uncomfortable.
Probably.
Like, very uncomfortable.
They had an eye on her, probably. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So in 1927, Polly finished her second high school degree, and she was inspired to attend Columbia University, but she was rejected because of her gender. So what you're going to see a lot with Polly Murray is there's a lot of intersections at play. She was kind of one of the first people to really point out what it's like to exist within these different margins and how they intersect together and how they make your life more difficult.
Yeah.
Later on, we'll detail it, but like she actually even called out like the civil rights movement and stuff in like the 50s and 60s for not being inclusive to women.
Yeah.
You know, so. Totally. So, yeah. So she couldn't attend their sister college, Bernard, because she couldn't afford it. So she attended Hunter College, a free city college where she was one of the only people of color in attendance.
Wow.
She graduated in 1933 with a bachelor's in English, and she graduated right in the middle of the Great Depression. So
yes.
She wasn't really able to find work after this.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had to abandon her studies for a little while and go work. Polly had gotten married in secret in 1930 to a man named Roy Wynn. However, this marriage quickly fell apart. Historian Rosalind Rosenberg said, "Their honeymoon weekend spent in a cheap West Side hotel was a disaster, an experience that she later attributed to their youth and poverty. The truth was more complicated. As Polly explained in notes to herself a few years later, she felt repelled by the act of sexual intercourse.
Mm.
Part of her wanted to be a normal woman, but another part resisted. Why is it when men try to make love to me, something in me fights?"
Mm-hmm.
So she had the marriage annulled a few years later. Like,
was there any history of like sexual assault that we know of with her?
Not that we know of, but I think it'll become a little bit more clear.
Okay.
Here in a couple paragraphs.
All right, let's do it.
So she took several jobs during the Depression, and one was as a remedial teacher, and she began like writing. She had several of her works published in the paper. But then she took a position at Camp Tara, which was a camp created by Eleanor Roosevelt to provide employment for young women. And there she met Eleanor Roosevelt, and they actually developed like a lifelong friendship. They remained friends until Eleanor died a few decades later. Here, she also had her first reported relationship with a woman who was a white camp counselor named Peg Holmes.
That was my second guess.
Yes, yeah. So
I was wondering, there are like theories that Eleanor Roosevelt was gay.
I've heard
that
as well.
So I thought you were going to say that there, I thought you were going to bring that up, like maybe that was her.
Well,
like,
I didn't read anything about that, but they did have a very close friendship.
And they could have just been a friendship.
Yeah, it could have just been a friendship. We don't know.
Just because they're gay doesn't mean they were together.
We don't
but
know. So the camp's director, the camp director at Camp Tara, disapproved of Polly, partially because while Polly was there, she had some of her school textbooks, and some of them were communist literature. And so the camp director found that and was already like, not about it. But then also when the camp director found out about Peg and Polly, it was a problem not only because it was a homosexual relationship, but it was also an interracial relationship.
Yeah. Peg and Polly.
Peg and Polly. So the two of them actually left the camp together, and they traveled the country walking, hitchhiking, and hopping freight trains.
Yeah, girls, do it. It's very unsafe, but like,
very
live
unsafe,
your lives.
But also.
But love.
But it's very romantic to
it
look
is.
Back on now, knowing that they came out of it
alive.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Murray applied to the University of North Carolina in 1938 to attend their graduate program, but was rejected because of her race. So she was rejected from Columbia because of her gender. And then she was rejected from the University of North Carolina because of her race. So all schools and other public facilities in the state at the time were segregated by law. So this is kind of the first time when she starts becoming interested in civil rights. She's like, this segregation shit, I'm not about it.
No, it's gotta end, man.
So she began a national campaign to overturn their decision, and it was widely reported on in both black and white newspapers. She wrote to officials talking about the university. She wrote to the university president, President Roosevelt, and she would release their responses, whatever they said back to her, she would release it in the newspaper. She would publish it in
That's
the media.
That's a great idea.
It went in an attempt to embarrass them. It was like she was trying to shame them into doing the right thing, basically.
Yeah.
The NAACP initially was interested in taking her case, but later declined to represent her in court. NAACP leader Roy Wilkins opposed representing her because Murray had already released her correspondence, which he considered to be not a diplomatic move. So he wrote to her. She had written to him asking for something.
Yeah.
He wrote back, and I'm guessing it was not so nice, and she published it.
I was just going to say, I bet that girl published it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it upset him. He phrased it in saying that it wasn't a diplomatic move. It wasn't, mm-hmm. like, a smart move. So there was partly that. Like, he didn't want to represent her because of that. They also said that it had something to do with being, like, a New York case. But a lot of people speculate that there were concerns about her sexuality. She wore pants instead of skirts. And she was very open about her relationships with women. She didn't really try and hide it.
Right. Well, and as we know, you know, the NAACP did so much good, but it was also...
It's a very flawed system.
It was very flawed. I mean, when we look at the history of intersectionality, which we will do very soon,
mm-hmm.
you know, the feminist movement wasn't inclusive to the Black population,
mm-hmm.
and the NAACP was not open to women in general, and definitely when it came to different sexualities.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was, like, too much. You know, these different groups were very much like, let's focus at the task at hand. They weren't inclusive
right.
to
yes,
all.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, you can understand that and sympathize with that to a certain degree. They're like, one thing at a time. We want to get these things done one thing at a time. But it makes it very difficult for people living in those intersections because... You know, your
they don't
needs,
have a way to turn.
Right, your needs aren't being met, really. Yeah. Like, not fully, either
and where,
way you go.
And where is she supposed to go if the NAACP doesn't help her?
Right, exactly. You know? Exactly. So, in early 1940, Murray was walking the streets of Rhode Island. She was distraught after the disappearance of a woman friend. So, people now speculate that this was, like, a romantic kind of relationship that had gone wrong, and she was upset. So she was just walking around the street, upset, as you do. I've definitely been in public being overly emotional. And she was taken into custody by police, just picked up off the street, and transferred to Bellevue Hospital in New York City for psychiatric treatment.
What the fuck?
They basically picked her up. They were like, she's hysterical. And then they, like, threw her into psychiatric treatment at Bellevue.
She's crying.
Yeah. So, in March, Murray left the hospital. And
after probably experiencing horrible abuse.
Probably. And she'd been there for a couple months, I think, at this point. So, anytime you're being held without your consent, you know, you can only imagine it's not great.
Well, and especially the fact that she is a gay Black woman.
Right. Right. And
doesn't look good.
She left the hospital with her roommate and girlfriend, Adeline McBean. They left together.
So, did they meet in the hospital?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. That I'm unclear about. I don't know if they were roommates in the hospital or roommates outside. I'm not sure.
So Peg is gone.
Peg is gone. Yeah, okay. At this point. So they took a bus to Durham to visit Pauline. And when they were in Virginia on their way to Durham, the two women, so Adeline McBean is also a Black woman. So the two women moved out of the broken seats in the back of the bus and moved into the front section of the bus.
Oh, God. I'm seeing so many parallels of other... I was thinking Ruby Bridges earlier, mm-hmm. with the education, and mm-hmm. now I'm thinking Rosa Parks.
Oh, and it all ties together,
it
too.
Does.
And that's what's amazing is, like, this is in 1940.
Yeah.
So this is years and years before Rosa Parks did what she did.
Okay.
So they moved into the white section. They had just had kind of an academic conversation about Gandhian civil disobedience.
Yeah.
So they basically were like, we're going to try this, like, civil disobedience thing. So whenever people told them to move, they didn't move. They called the police and they still didn't move. So they were arrested and thrown in jail. Murray and McBean initially were defended by the NAACP, but when the pair were convicted only of disorderly conduct rather than violating segregation laws, the organization decided to stop representing them. So basically, the NAACP only wanted to represent them if it was, like, a segregation issue, which it was, but they weren't charged with segregation laws. They were charged with disorderly conduct.
So
they withdrew their defense.
It's a sneaky move by the mm-hmm. court.
Yeah, it is. Because, again, while I think it's the wrong move, I also understand that the NAACP needs to be very careful about, like, how they move forward.
And where they put their support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because...
It's definitely a complicated
situation. Right, because this can look like you're defending disorderly you know, conduct.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, they're not being charged with any race-related law, so why are you here?
Right.
You
know? We have to defend those who are being charged with segregation laws.
Right,
I get that.
Right. So the Workers' Defense League, the WDL, which is a socialist labor rights organization, and they were beginning to take on civil rights cases, they decided to pay her fine and get her out of jail.
Good.
So a few months later, the WDL hired Murray for its administrative committee. And so while she was working with the WDL, Murray became active in a case of Odell Waller. Now, Odell Waller was a Virginia sharecropper who was charged with murdering the landowner that he was working for. And he said that it was self-defense, that they had gotten into a dispute because the landowner refused to pay him his portion of the shares or, right, like, give him his crop.
Yeah.
And so they got into a dispute and he killed him in self-defense. So the WDL took interest in this and they went down to help defend him and they were, like, fighting to defend him. Pauli Murray was very instrumental in getting a lot of, like, national coverage for him and things, yeah, like that. And she actually even wrote to Lady Eleanor Roosevelt on Waller's behalf, and Roosevelt, in turn, wrote to the Virginia governor asking him to guarantee that the trial would be fair.
Uh-huh.
And she later persuaded the president to privately request to the governor to commute the death sentence of Waller when he was convicted. So he was convicted by a jury of all white guys.
Of course.
So he ended up being convicted of first-degree murder. And unfortunately, despite all of that, and despite, like, their friendship, Pauli and Eleanor's and all the work that they both did to try and save, yeah, his life, it didn't work. He was put to death.
Oh, no.
Because of all this, Pauli became very, very interested in civil rights law.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1941, she began attending Howard University Law School.
Wow.
And she
Where's
was...
Where's she getting the money for all this? Damn.
Dude, I don't know. I don't know. Scholarships, maybe?
I hope so. My God.
And also, I mean, school was cheaper back then.
Yeah,
but
that's true. It's amazing.
She was the only woman in her law school class, and she became very, very aware of sexism within black communities.
Oh, like, my gosh.
You know, sexism within racism, and she called it Jane Crow, basically saying that it's like Jim Crow, but it affects black women differently, in a different way. So she called it Jane Crow, and actually a lot of, like, the work that has been written about her, that is one of her, like, big overarching.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
On Murray's first day of class, one professor, William Robert Ming, remarked that he did not know why women went to law school. But he was like, he said, I think in one of the things that I watched on YouTube, he said, I don't know why women come to law school, but they're here, boys, so you just have to deal with it. Like, basically.
I mean, he could say worse things.
He could say worse things. He could say better things.
Yeah.
You know. In 1942, while still in law school, Murray joined the Congress of Racial Equality, and later that year she published Negroes' Youth's Dilemma, which challenged segregation in the U.S. military, which had continued up until the Second World War, which is insane, okay? Like, if you're out fighting and dying for your fucking country, like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
She also participated in sit-ins, and this was, again, in the 1940s. So she's participating in civil disobedience. We credit all these other people with, like, starting this kind of, like, civil disobedience movement,
yeah,
and not to diminish, you know, Martin Luther King or anybody, like, not to diminish what they've done.
Of course
but
not.
I didn't know about...
Yeah, about, we didn't grow up learning about these people.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what I think is interesting is that she was inspired by Gandhi.
Yes.
You know, that was something that, you know, people's inspirations and ideas come from other things. Like, if we were to really peel back the layers of time,
mm-hmm,
to see what inspired Gandhi, what inspired, like, it's interesting how, you know, those people are all the backbones to what created the movements that we were taught in school.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and then the idea of, like, sit-in. So, like, actively, like, going and peacefully protesting,
yes,
essentially, which is, of course, something that was later taken on by the civil rights movement of the 1960s.
Yeah.
So she was participating in these things. And then she was elected Chief Justice of Howard Court of Peers, which is the highest student position in Howard.
Wow.
And she is the only woman in the law department there,
yeah,
at this time.
And she got it.
Yes, she got it. And
yes,
in 1944,
girl,
she graduated first in her class.
Of course she did.
So traditionally, men who graduated first in their class were awarded Julius Rosenwald fellowships for graduate work at Harvard University, but Harvard did not accept women. So she couldn't go to Harvard. And you know what? Yeah, she was rejected despite having a letter of support from President Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
What the fuck?
So she wrote to them and she said, "I would gladly change my sex to meet your requirements, but since the way to such change has not been revealed to me, I have no recourse but to appeal to you to change your minds. Are you to tell me that one is as difficult as the other?"
Oh my God.
So she's basically saying, like, it's a lot easier for you to change your rule about, like, letting a woman into school than it is for me to change my sex. Gender. So maybe you could just do that.
Yeah.
She did postgraduate work at Bullitt Hall School of Law at University of California in Berkeley, and her thesis for her master's degree was entitled "The Right to Equal Opportunity in Employment," which argued that the right to work is an inalienable right. Mm-hmm. Because she had now constantly been rejected, oftentimes on the basis of her sex, for equal work.
Yeah.
So she published that in the California Law Review. After passing the bar exam in 1945, she was hired as the state's first black deputy attorney general in January of the following year. That year, the National Council of Negro Women named her its Woman of the Year, and Mademoiselle magazine did the same in 1947.
Love it.
In 1950, Murray published States Laws on Race and Color, an examination and critique of state segregation laws throughout the nation, and she drew on psychological and sociological evidence as well as legal. So it's really interesting what she did here. So this she had brought up when she was in Howard. So basically, like, there had been a decision, a Supreme Court decision in 1896 called Plessy versus Ferguson, mm-hmm. which upheld segregation on the grounds that you could be separate and equal. Mm-hmm. So most of her peers and professors at Howard argued that the way to get around this, or the way to have this overturned, is to find arguments for the equal part of that. Like, right. basically, to argue
they
that
were not
portion
equal.
Of it. That we're
yeah.
not equal. But she said, she's like, we should argue the separate portion of it because I believe that if you are separated, it is inherently unequal.
Agreed.
So,
yeah.
But they were like, that's impractical. That will never work. But
right.
it did work. She wrote this and basically actually did psychological and sociological studies that showed how, like, damaging the separate part of that equation was.
Totally.
So Thurgood Marshall, then NAACP chief counsel and future Supreme Court justice, mm-hmm. he called Murray's book the Bible of the civil rights movement. And her approach was actually influential to the NAACP arguments in Brown versus the Board of Education, which is what
good.
We were talking about with, you know, Ruby Bridges.
Yes.
And they drew from the psychological studies that addressed the effects of segregation on students in school.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregated public schools were unconstitutional.
Good. Well, I knew that, but...
yeah. Still good. Still good. In 1963, she became one of the first to criticize the sexism of the civil rights movement in her speech, The Negro Woman in Her Quest for Equality. In a letter to civil rights leader A. Philip Randolph, she criticized the fact that in the 1963 March on Washington, no women were invited to make one of the major speeches or be part of its delegation of leaders who went to the White House. So she wrote, "I have been increasingly perturbed over the blatant disparity between the major role which Negro women have played and are playing in the crucial grassroots levels of our struggle and the minor role of leadership they have been assigned in the national policymaking decisions. It is indefensible to call a national march on Washington and send out a call which contains the name of not one single woman leader."
Yeah.
So what she's saying is something that, like, I feel like black women have said for a long time, which is, like, black women run these grassroots movements. We're doing all the legwork on the front end.
Like, and then we have somebody else being our spokesperson.
Right, and basically taking credit for everything. And she's right. Like, not to have anybody, no women got to speak at the March on Washington is insane. In 1965, she published her landmark article, co-authored by Mary Eastwood, Jane Crow and the Law, Sex Discrimination and Title VII, in the George Washington Law Review. So basically, it drew comparisons between discriminatory laws against women and Jim Crow laws. Mm-hmm. So basically saying, like, yes, they're different, all of these laws, you're fighting for these laws against Jim Crow when there are also all of these laws that keep women from doing things and keep them separated, like, in the workplace and other places. Mm-hmm. So in 1966, she was the co-founder for the National Organization of Women.
Love it.
And she also attended Yale Law School in 1965.
Girl.
Becoming the first African-American to receive a Doctor of the Science of Law degree in the school.
Insane.
Later in 1966, she and Dorothy Kenyon successfully argued White v. Cook, which was a case in which the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Fifth Court ruled that women have the equal right to serve on juries.
Okay.
When future lawyer and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote her brief for Reed v. Reed, a 1971 Supreme Court case that, for the first time, extended the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause to women, she added that Murray and Kenyon, she added them as co-authors to...
That's so cool.
Yeah, to her brief because she used their work so heavily whenever she was writing her brief.
So it is wild to think that she's been a Supreme Court justice for that
forever.
It's crazy.
For so long. Murray served as vice president of Benedict College from 1967 to 68, and she left to teach at Brandeis University in 1968 to 1973, where she received full tenure as a professor. And in addition to teaching law, she actually introduced classes on African-American studies and women's studies, which were both firsts for the university.
Wow.
So she was like, she went to Brandeis and was like, we're gonna do a whole overhaul here.
Yeah, we need to have this education available mm-hmm. for people. Mm-hmm.
Inspired by her connections with women in the Episcopal Church. This woman is insane. Like, I can't even imagine.
Episcopal Church? Yeah, where did we come from?
I left out a lot of shit. Like, she went to an Episcopal church whenever she went to North Carolina. I think even her school was an Episcopalian church, school. So it was...
She must have been one of those people that was so likable.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's, you know, she's got friends in low places. You know what I mean? Like, it just has these connections with these people where she must have been not only so intelligent, but so likable.
I think she was just kind of a force of nature because she was a very small woman. And I've heard her even...
I looked at pictures of her while you were talking.
I've heard her even described as, like, shrill, almost, like, in the way that she spoke, which lots of women are described as shrill. But, and I've heard that some people, a lot of men, I don't think, liked her very much because she... said what she wanted, you know, and said what she thought. But I think she was just kind of a force of nature. If she wanted to do something, she found a way to do it.
Yeah, but the fact that she had the support.
Yeah, she could bring people to her side.
Yeah, to me, makes me believe that she had something very special about her personality.
Yeah, you know, magnetic charisma.
She wasn't just smart. She had something behind her that could push her career forward. Mm-hmm. It's that it factor that you see even in Hollywood and with actors, but this is more of an activist type.
Yeah, I think it's the only way to accomplish as much as she has accomplished.
She has something special about her.
Yeah. So she, when she was 60 years old, she left Brandeis to attend seminary at 60. And she was ordained.
That's dope.
Yes. She was ordained in 1976. And after 3 years of study, and in 1977, she became the first African-American woman ordained as an Episcopal priest and was among the first generation of Episcopal women priests. So she was the first Black woman to be an Episcopal priest.
Did you know that I got ordained over the holiday break?
Oh, so you can marry people now?
I can.
Good
for
you.
Yeah, it takes 2 minutes. There's a website.
I know.
My friend Trevor is officiating Haley's wedding, mm-hmm. and we were at the dinner table on Christmas, and he's like, you want to be ordained? I can ordain you right now.
You're like,
and
yes, did. I would. Thank you so much.
I am Her Holiness Madigan.
Oh.
Max is ordained, too. He's Reverend
Dean Maxwell.
Yes, it's very official. When you sign up, it's like, you're hashtag ordained. And I'm like, what?
Fantastic.
Hashtag ordained, everybody.
So
hashtag
easy. Ordained. I should do that before they make it more difficult, because I'm sure eventually
I'll
they will.
I'll do it for you right now.
So for the next 7 years, Murray worked in a parish in Washington, D.C., focusing primarily on ministry to the sick. So in addition to the work in law that she did, she was also a poet and an accomplished writer. She wrote a memoir called Proud Shoes, and it was released in 1956. And this is fascinating. Again, we can't go into it, but it details her family's really complicated history with race. Because, like I said, she was raised a lot by her grandparents, and her grandmother, Cornelia, was biracial. Her mother, so Polly's great-grandmother, had been a slave who was raped by not only her white slave master, but also his brother. So that's how her grandmother came about. She was a product of rape. slave rape. Yeah. So she was then raised, Cornelia was then raised by her father's sister and educated. So her slave master's sister took her in and educated her. And then she went off and married a freed black man. Okay. Who was Polly's great-grandfather.
Damn, I gotta read this memoir.
Yeah, yeah. This so I want to read it, too. Yeah. So it's called Proud Shoes. And then she released a collection of poems in 1970. Mm. And on July 1st, 1985, Polly Murray died of pancreatic cancer in the house she owned with lifelong friend Mitre Springer Kemp in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So, okay, there's all that. I had a hard time kind of, like, fitting this in, but I think we should talk about it.
Okay.
There has been some speculation as to Polly's gender identity.
Okay.
In some of her writings, she alludes to feeling uncomfortable in her skin as a woman, and although acknowledging the term homosexual in describing others, Murray described herself as having an, quote, inverted sex instinct that caused her to behave as a man attracted to women.
And then I apologize for saying go girl so many times during this episode.
But no, like, that's where it becomes difficult. There's actually a lot of writings that I'll touch on briefly that it's made it kind of hard because
there wasn't the language back then.
Right. There have been historians who want to refer to her as him, but she never explicitly came out and gave her pronouns. So we also don't know if we want to speculate in that
too
way.
Much. Yeah, exactly. We don't want to go against her wishes or what she identified as.
Exactly.
Right? But that is, you know, I then apologize for saying go girl the whole time because we don't know.
I mean, we don't know, but I think she referred to herself as she, like, throughout her life.
Right.
And I don't think she had the language. That's exactly right.
Exactly.
Because she said that she wanted a monogamous married life, but one in which she was the man. Right. But it's unclear if that means she wanted to be a man or if she just felt like her
role
and that the way that she felt towards women didn't feel like a lesbian relationship. To me, it almost sounds like she's more of like a gender fluid type person where she's like kind of somewhere in between.
Or it could be that her personality she felt to be more of the role of what a man would be in a relationship.
Yes.
You know, she could have identified still as with some female characteristics, but maybe in relationships she felt a more masculine typical role.
Yeah, so to me she kind of sounds like gender fluid in a way. The majority of her relationships were with women whom she described as extremely feminine and heterosexual. Like, she felt like the women she was with were...
She liked very, like, femme lesbians.
Yes, and Yeah. That's basically, I think, what she's saying.
I love this person.
Yeah, like, she's interesting. She's so interesting. She wore her hair short and preferred pants to skirts, and due to her slight build, she would oftentimes pass as a teenage boy. In her 20s, she shortened her name from Pauline to Polly, which is more androgynous, and at the time of her arrest for the bus segregation protest in 1940, she gave the name Oliver to the arresting officers. She also, and this is, I think, where people start to think maybe she was trans, is she pursued hormone treatments in the 1940s to correct what she saw was a personal imbalance. And I don't know if that means that she's trans or if she felt there was a hormone imbalance that she thought that could be corrected.
There's many ways to look at it. I don't know the history of hormone therapy for the transgender community, especially during that time. I don't know if that was a science that was available, but maybe there was something with her just knowledge and being so smart. That was a way for her to feel, you know, it could have been a psychological, you know, mental hormone imbalance, or it could have been something that she was working toward when it came to her gender identity.
Right. I mean, I do think that she felt something was physically not right because she even thought, like, that maybe she was intersex. Like, maybe, like, if she were to be cut open, she might have, like,
male. She could have been, yeah.
Right, yeah. She actually, you know, kind of questioned that in her writings. Like, if I were to go and have surgery and if they were to cut me open, would they find male, like, male sex organs as well? You know,
I'm so fascinated by her thought process being so today. You know what I mean?
Right, but obviously also coming from a place of not having the language or understanding
and
that,
no,
like,
information out there for her to ever go off of. She just had this feeling inherently where she knew both with her sexuality and her gender.
Right.
But she wasn't able to put the words and the science behind
it. And she didn't, like, it's why it's so important that we have these open conversations about, like, gender fluidity and stuff like that now, so that people can know, like, there's nothing wrong with you. Like, if you're having these thoughts, you know, there's nothing wrong with you.
There's nothing wrong with your identity.
Right. No.
Whatever you identify as is your identity.
That's right.
Yeah.
So historian Rosalind Rosenberg considers Polly to be a transgender man, and she says that that's what she believes. She wrote an entire book biography about her, and in fact wrote whole passages using, you know, he, him pronouns.
Yeah.
But even she had to say, like, but it's, I had to go back and change some of those because it doesn't feel right to speculate either. It's hard to know what the most respectful thing to do is.
Right.
You know?
It's not right to speculate, but it's right to be respectful.
Right.
And now I think what is good is that you don't have to use just a she or a him pronoun. There's they.
Yeah. And it's possible that had she been around today, maybe she would have gone by they.
Well, like, and I wonder if that's the most respectful way to go about it in this day and age when referencing them is saying them or they.
Right.
Because you don't know. Maybe that's the most respectful way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
in
true.
This day and age, you know?
Yeah.
We don't know.
So.
What?
What a life.
What a. I mean, that's. Isn't that the consensus every time we do these? Or we're like, what are we doing with our lives?
Oh,
these
every
people,
time I feel like, yeah, I didn't do enough.
Yeah. It's crazy, but these stories are so inspiring and amazing, and I love it.
Yeah.
So I am talking about probably one of the most infamous feminists from the second wave on.
Okay.
I'm talking about Gloria Steinem.
I knew you were. As soon as you were like, it's probably one of the most well-known names in feminism.
And just so you know, my car's name is Gloria, after Gloria Steinem. I have my big feminist sticker on the back. So if you're in LA and you see a car with a bunch of, like, a rundown looking car with a bunch of stickers with a feminist sticker
Girl,
on the back.
Girl, don't out yourself like that.
It's me. But that's Gloria. She doesn't work very well, but she gets me where I need to go. She makes a lot of noise, but what are you going to do? So I had heard this name my entire life. I know about the Miss Magazine cover. I've seen her face and I've seen her speeches, but I don't really know her whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you know, we have a lot of young listeners, and I don't know if a lot of young listeners would know her story either. So I thought I would go the more not quite forgotten, but maybe not fully discovered feminist fave.
And probably misunderstood in a lot of ways.
Yes.
I think people know the big things.
She is a multifaceted woman, and actually I almost did this episode about her grandmother.
Oh.
But there wasn't enough information, but I will touch on her. So she is considered to be a liberal feminist. She characterizes herself as a radical feminist. She, you know, has been kind of pushed into this feminist role, she says, because there wasn't a specific movement for her. But she's kind of been in multiple different movements as her life has gone on.
Mm-hmm.
She's just an activist through and through. So she sees herself as being more radical, necessarily, than just pigeonholing her into one specific group.
Sure.
So Gloria Steinem was born on March 25th, 1934, in Toledo, Ohio, to a Presbyterian mother and a Jewish father. Her paternal grandmother was Pauline Perlmutter Steinem. Look her up. She's rad.
So many Paulines.
She was a suffragist, a chairwoman of the Educational Committee of the National Women's Suffrage Association, a delegate to the 1908 International Council of Women, and the first woman to be elected to the Toledo Board of Education. She also rescued family members from the Holocaust. That last part pulled me in, and I couldn't find anything online that would tell me more about that.
There's nothing that you can find, you know.
But she's from Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And her family moved to Toledo, Ohio. So when she grew up, the grandmother grew up in Toledo, Ohio. And I guess during World War II had some ties to that family still, trying to bring them to safety and things like that. Gloria's family lived and traveled in a trailer where her father, Leo, sold antiques. It was like an antique roadshow.
A traveling antique.
Yeah, they lived in
caravan.
Yeah, pretty much. Before Gloria was born, her mother, Ruth, at age 34, had a nervous breakdown, they say, which left her as an invalid. She was then trapped in delusional fantasies that would sometimes turn violent. She couldn't hold down a job, and her personality was forever changed.
This is her mom,
ugh. Yeah. And she spent a lot of time in and out of mental hospitals. Because of this, when Gloria was 10, her parents separated. So, yeah, her mother suffered from some nervous break and was taken into mental hospitals.
That's really sad.
It's very sad. And she actually, she says later that her mother's illness and treatment from doctors was pivotal in her understanding of social justice. And she showed that women lacked social and political equality. Kind of what we were talking about earlier.
Right.
You know, these mental health institutions at the time.
Right. Especially, like, if you don't have the same amount of rights, you can't advocate for yourself. Like,
right.
In the
and
same
even,
way.
Even the statement of having a nervous breakdown, you know, I was always told that my grandmother had kind of a nervous breakdown when my mom was young, and it kind of left her a very different woman. And there wasn't really a language at the time for what specifically maybe brought that on, what her mental illness was, anything like that. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any knowledge on that. And I think that especially with her being a woman, calling it a nervous breakdown is definitely more of a female identifier.
Right. It's almost like hysteria,
identifier.
Right?
Yeah,
where it's
exactly.
just like there's these things that you can say that almost diminish it in a
yeah.
way.
Yeah. Know? Oh, she had a nervous breakdown. Whatever.
Right. Yeah.
She's emotional.
And I think it insinuates that their constitutions are like inherently weaker.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily what happen there.
No.
I mean, look at nowadays, we do still use the words nervous breakdown, but not nearly as often.
And it's,
you know?
And it's usually referring to something less severe. Like, I would consider Britney Spears in 2007 to be a nervous breakdown.
Yeah. I mean,
you know what I mean?
Without knowing what else was going on.
Yeah. What we just saw, what we
mm-hmm.
saw.
Yeah.
So, Gloria graduated from Smith College, then went on to India as a Chester Bowles Asian Fellow, where she was briefly on the Supreme Court of India as a law clerk.
Interesting.
Right? There's so much shit about her that I didn't know. And by the way, I'm leaving so much stuff out.
It's impossible not to.
I had more than 4 pages and I was not even done. So I went back and I deleted a lot of stuff, but there was so much about her that I didn't know. And it was so fascinating. So when she returned to the United States, she became the director of the Independent Research Service, which was actually funded by the CIA. And there's a lot of kind of like question and lore around all of this being funded by the CIA. She worked to send non-communist American students to the 1959 World Youth Festival. And finally, in 1960, she was hired as the first employee of Help magazine. I say it like that because it has an exclamation point at the end, like the Beatles song.
What does it mean?
Help!
No, I mean,
somebody.
The magazine, like, what is it for?
It didn't say.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
Help. Well, she's a writer. She worked for Help magazine, whatever. Esquire magazine gave Gloria her first, quote, serious assignment, which was regarding contraception. In 1962, the article was about how women were forced to choose between having a career and marriage, which at the time, marriage means then bearing children.
Yes.
The article preceded the Feminine Mystique by only 1 year. So her article speaking about the choices between being a career woman and what that meant in society and being a wife and what that meant in society, which is a similar idea to the Feminine Mystique, was actually a year before mm-hmm. that book came out. In 1963, while working for Show magazine, Gloria was employed as a Playboy bunny at the New York Playboy Club. Now, this is an image that I think is very popular of Gloria Steinem in the 60s as a Playboy bunny, going undercover, mm-hmm. learning about all this stuff. This is something I think that most people kind of know about.
This would be probably the biggest thing that most people would know about
exactly.
Gloria Steinem. Yeah.
So the article written about her time as a bunny was called A Bunny's Tale, which showed a photo of Gloria in the bunny uniform, which we just discussed. The article detailed how women were being treated at this club by publicizing the exploitative working conditions, especially the sexual demands made of them. In 1964, she conducted an interview with John Lennon. She wrote for a show called That Was the Week It Was. The Week That Was, something like it. Weird title
I feel
of the
like,
show.
Yeah, I feel like they could have done a better job
and
with that title.
Maybe that's why it wasn't very popular. That was in 1965. She wrote especially on a segment called Surrealism in Everyday Life and was eventually hired at New York Magazine. In 1969, she covered an abortion speak-out, which was held in a church basement in Greenwich Village. Gloria herself had had an abortion at the age of 22, and she says that being at the speak-out was like a light bulb moment for her. She says she didn't begin her life as an active feminist until that day. She recalls it, abortion, is supposed to make us a bad person, but I must say I never felt that. I used to sit and try to figure out how old the child would be, trying to make myself feel guilty, but I never could. I think the person who said, honey, if men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament, was right. Speaking for myself, I knew it was the first time I had taken responsibility for my own life. I wasn't going to let things happen to me. I was going to direct my life, and therefore it felt positive. But still, I didn't tell anyone, because I knew that out there, it wasn't, and then in parentheticals, positive. Also in 1969, she published an article, After Black Power, Women's Liberation, which brought her national fame as a feminist leader. Because of this article, she went on to campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment, testifying before the Senate. In July of 1971, she became one of over 300 women who founded the National Women's Political Caucus. She delivered a speech titled, Address to the Women of America. In that speech, she says, this is no simple reform. It really is a revolution. Sex and race, because they are easy and visible differences, have been the primary ways of organizing human beings into superior and inferior groups and into cheap labor of which this system still depends.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about a society in which there will be no roles other than those chosen or those earned. We are talking about humanism.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And I think that that is the most... I don't understand why that portion of her speech isn't used more frequently in feminist dialogue.
I agree.
Because I think
she is seen very much as a white feminist.
She is. But I do think that that portion of her speech most easily and concisely defines what feminism is,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like, we are talking about a society in which the only roles that are assigned are ones that are earned by merit and not from, like, physical differences, because we as human beings have done that. It's like race and gender are the most easily
obvious.
Identifiable, you know, differences. And that's what feminism is. She says humanism, but that's what feminism is.
But haven't you spoken in the past about a lot of the Black community referring to humanism?
Black feminists, a lot of Black feminists call it womanism rather than feminism.
That's right.
Because of the issues between Black civil rights and feminism in the past, because of white feminism, essentially.
Yeah.
Because white feminism has for so many years, I feel like it's starting to turn around now, but white feminism did kind of take the word feminism for so long that Black women decided to start calling themselves womanists.
I like that. Another thing she is probably most famous for is that in 1972, she and Dorothy Pittman Hughes started Miss Magazine. Its 3,000 test copies sold nationwide in 8 days. Within weeks, Miss Magazine had received 26,000 subscription orders and over 20,000 reader letters. So that shit got popular real fast.
Well, anytime there's like a void, right? Like someone needed to fill this void. There wasn't a desire for this kind of content.
Yeah.
Someone needed to create it.
So, Gloria Steinem grew up as a big fan of Wonder Woman. So, in 1973, she was the key player in the restoration of Wonder Woman's costume and powers. She was offended that the most famous female superhero had been depowered. So, she put Wonder Woman on the cover of her first issue of Miss Magazine. So, I think she is a lot to be thankful for the way that we perceive Wonder Woman.
Absolutely.
In 1978, she wrote a semi-satirical essay for Cosmo titled, If Men Could Menstruate, where she concluded the essay that in such a world, menstruation would become a badge of honor with men comparing their relative sufferings rather than a source of shame.
Did you
is so true.
Did you watch Michelle Wolf's new stand-up?
No, Max isn't a big fan, so we love watching...
I like her.
It's her voice that bugs him, which I can't really argue, but my mom watched it.
You know what's
really
weird is, like, Anthony likes her voice.
Oh.
And her voice is weird. Her voice is grating.
I mean, I enjoy when people have interesting voices. Sometimes it can be distracting. Sometimes it can be, it can add to
But she
them.
Has a whole segment about, like, if men could have periods.
And, like, you know, there's that whole thing of, like, when men get sick, it's such a bigger deal than when women get sick. You know, it's like they would compare their suffering. So, like, oh, my cramps are worse. No, my cramps are worse.
It would totally be a completely different thing. It wouldn't be seen as weak because men wouldn't be able to frame it that way. So they would have to reframe it as something that's, like...
And it wouldn't be a source of shame. It wouldn't be a shameful thing. Exactly. Also, in 1972, she ran as a delegate for Shirley Chisholm.
Oh, hey.
Didn't know that. In 1984, Gloria was arrested along with a number of other members of Congress and civil rights activists for disorderly conduct outside the South African embassy while protesting against the South African apartheid system. During the Clarence Thomas sexual harassment scandal in 1991, she voiced her support for Anita Hill and suggested that one day Anita Hill herself would sit on the Supreme Court.
Ugh, if only.
I know, right? The quote, "A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle," was actually not coined by Steinem, but Irina Dunn, an Australian activist, when they started releasing that quote and using her name underneath it, she was like, no, I didn't start that. This other woman did.
Well, God bless her for doing that, but unfortunately, it still lingers on as a quote. It's credited to Steinem time I see it. Yeah. So what a bummer for Irina Dunn.
Yeah, I mean, it was popularized, I think, by Steinem, but yes, she made it a point to say, I didn't say that first, which I think is great. Steinem has been involved in multiple political campaigns, such as the 1968 election, where she was firmly against the Vietnam War. She originally supported Eugene McCarthy, but went on to support George McGovern. In 1972, she was reluctant to support McGovern, however, as she felt she was mistreated by his staff. When McGovern removed the abortion issue from his platform, Steinem wrote against his decision.
Well, I mean, and McGovern is the one who ended up getting the nomination the year that Shirley Chisholm ran for president.
Exactly.
So I imagine that, like, once you lost Chisholm, it's like, well, what do we do?
Yeah, I guess we got to go with this guy. In 2004, she voted criticism of George W. Bush's administration, saying, "There has never been an administration that has been more hostile to women's equality, to reproductive freedom as a fundamental human right, and has acted on that hostility. If he's elected in 2004, abortion will be criminalized in this country." And I'm like, girl, wait for Trump.
Yeah.
Just you wait. At a Planned Parenthood event, she declared Bush a, quote, "danger to health and safety," citing his antagonism to the Clean Water Act, reproductive freedom, sex education, and AIDS relief. Steinem was supportive of both Democratic nominees in 2008 election, saying that both Senators Clinton and Obama are civil rights advocates, feminists, environmentalists, and critics of the war in Iraq. Both have resisted pandering to the right, something that sets them apart from any Republican candidate, including John McCain. Both have Washington and foreign policy experience. George W. Bush did not when he ran for president.
Ugh, fucking nepotism, man.
Yeah, and she received criticism for downplaying the importance of John McCain's time as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. But she argues that was the media and the political world are too admiring of militarism and all its guises, she says.
I mean, I do agree with her. I mean, I think anybody who faces that kind of, like, being a prisoner of war would be,
like,
horrifying.
Recognize it, but that doesn't mean, like, you know, our political system holds that as such a high honor, which I understand because the military is such a political
role. Yeah, yeah. I think don't support militarism, but acknowledge anyone who's been through torture.
Well, and that's the thing is that she was not downplaying,
right, of course,
his torture. She said, you know, even John McCain isn't viewing, you know, reproductive issues, the war in Iraq, different things like that, the same as Clinton and Obama.
Yeah.
That's all she was saying. She wasn't trying to discredit his prisoner of war status.
Absolutely. I see what you're saying. Yes.
But people, of course, came for her and said, you know, what about this? So she eventually sided with Clinton because of her broader experience, saying the country was in such bad shape that they would need two terms of Clinton and two terms of Obama to clean up this mess.
Yeah.
Ugh, if only, right? She also wrote an op-ed for the New York Times stating that gender, not race, is the most restricting force in America because black men were given the right to vote a half century before women exactly any race were allowed to vote.
This is why people think she's a white feminist.
Yes.
Because, wow.
So, this is what happened. She had critics saying that white women received the right to vote in 1920, where black men and women could not vote until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and some were lynched for trying. And the thing that I like about Gloria Steinem, while I believe, because it is so easy as a white woman, especially during the second wave and ongoing, to remain in a very white feminist mindset. And the reason that I wanted to mention her shortcomings is because I believe that she has learned a lot from what she said and from her critics. She's not a person who gets criticism and then completely says, you're wrong, or I never did that. She's able to kind of look at those pieces and be able to learn from that. And I think that's why she's still relevant today.
Right. No, and I like Gloria Steinem, but I will argue that that's something that she shouldn't have had to have been told. And, like, I think that that's when people of color get frustrated.
Yeah.
Because it's like Gloria Steinem. You were around, you existed within both like the women's rights movement and the civil rights movement in the 1960s. There's no reason why you had to be told that this was inaccurate, that saying that women were more oppressed than people of color.
And I think that she could have worded it in a way where, you know, we were just talking about the NAACP and how, and the sexism that surrounds the civil rights movement. And I think that she could have put it in a way where it didn't seem like she was talking about herself. And like, if she was talking about black women.
Sure. Yes. I think if you wanted to explicitly say women of color.
Yes, but she didn't.
Are the most oppressed, or, you know, women, trans women of color. If you were to say something like that, I think that argument would hold more water. But to say across the board, there were so many white women who benefited from racism.
Yeah.
That you really can't make that statement.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, she has
not perfect. Not perfect,
but. Not perfect at all. In 2016, she supported Bernie Sanders and then later endorsed Clinton. In 1986, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and trigeminal neuralgia.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
In 1994. In 2000, she married Christian Bale's dad, David Bale.
What?
Yes, you didn't know that?
No.
Yeah. I once read
Christian
this article.
Christian Bale's mom-in-law, or stepmom,
is Gloria Steinem.
Wow.
Well, I think his dad is dead now. But yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, I read an article once where it's like, famous people you didn't know were related, and I read that, and I was like, that's weird.
Very.
Well, they're not related, but by marriage.
But yes, stepmom.
Yep. So these are some of her political positions. She is against genital mutilation and male circumcision.
Okay.
She helped bring attention to female genital mutilation to the American public. She states in a Miss article in 1979, the real reasons for genital mutilation can only be understood in the context of the patriarchy. Men must control women's bodies as means of production and thus repress the independent power of women's sexuality. On male circumcision, she says, these patriarchal controls limit in men's sexuality, too. That's why men are asked symbolically to submit the sexual part of themselves and their sons to the patriarchal authority, which seems to be the origin of male circumcision, a proactive that, even as advocates admit, is medically unnecessary 90% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking for myself, I stand with my brothers in eliminating that practice, too. She also speaks about pornography. Steinem has criticized pornography, which she distinguishes from erotica, saying erotica is as different from pornography as love is from rape, focusing on the distinction between consent and domination and criticizing the lack of equal power between the sexes in porn. And she even goes on to speak about, like, gay porn and how even, like, lesbian and gay porn has a certain power dynamic, has a certain view of the male gaze.
Sure.
Things like that. She has also been criticized for her views on transgender sexual reassignment surgery from a 1977 article, but in 2013 showed her support for the transgender community, recognizing her past shortcomings. And that's a big thing that I feel is the biggest difference between, like, the second wave feminists and the fourth wave feminists, is a lot of the LGBTQ plus issues.
Well, they're, yeah, I mean, because I had heard that too, that that she's considered a TERF, which is a trans exclusionary radical feminist.
But she has since, well, that was from a 1977 article, and I think from what I've read, she has worked to
ratify that. Yeah, our understanding has changed.
Yeah, and I think that for her, you know, she had a strong force against genital mutilation and circumcision, and from what I read, her understanding of gender reassignment surgery was kind of another way of enforcing genitalia mutilation.
Interesting.
So I think that our understanding of, you know, a gender reassignment surgery back in the 70s was very different than our understanding of it today. I'm not trying to make excuses for her, but it seems like she has acknowledged her shortcomings at the time. I mean, that was almost 40 years later, you know, when she came out in 2013, when that was brought up again, and she was like, that is not my belief today. And I think that's the most important thing to remember about being a feminist, is that the things you and I are discussing even right now, in 40 years, we could be saying, well, what about this, that, and the other thing?
Right.
We're not even touching those topics.
Mm-hmm.
She's not perfect. No feminist is perfect. No person is perfect. And I think time reveals a lot.
Right.
You know? She has received multiple awards and published many written works. If I were to go into all of them, we would be here until next Tuesday. She is known as a leader of second wave feminism and has shown how one can go seamlessly from a second wave way of thinking all the way into the fourth wave. She continues to speak out on feminist issues and continues to be one of the most recognizable faces in feminism.
Amen.
Amen. In her word. Amen. So I could have gone on with that for so much longer.
Yeah.
I deleted like 2 pages of notes. So that is nowhere near the entirety of Gloria Steinem. That is a very like Wikipedia-based, biography.com-based short story that I just gave everybody. There's so much more to her. She is fascinating. I like reading about feminists that have their shortcomings and about how times have changed.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the fact that she has remained very steadfast in her beliefs. She hasn't wavered from those beliefs, and that she has been able to adapt through generations of feminism. And
yeah.
I think that's really admirable.
Absolutely. Well, that's awesome. I mean, I probably should have edited mine down on Polly Murray.
No, because I loved it. And I had no... because people know who Gloria Steinem is. They can remember her name, Google it. But Polly Murray is not a name that is, like, well-known. I'm glad that you took that time and told us about it.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we were able to cover these women today. I think it's a great start to the new year.
Yes.
It's very exciting.
We started it our favorite way.
We did.
Doing some book report style research.
Yeah, so we're happy to be back. We hope you guys are happy that we're back. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
Yeah.
If you have suggestions on future episode topics, we would love to hear those. You can go ahead and email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com.
I just want to say really quick that we did receive some emails while we were on our break.
Oh,
with
yeah.
Episode ideas.
Yes.
I want everybody to know who emailed us that those suggestions have been put into our list of episodes that we have. So thank you, thank you, thank you, because it really helped us during this break kind of look at some of the things that our listeners want. And they have been added to the list. So if they're not, you know, done right away, know that they are in our repertoire. It will be covered eventually.
Yeah,
so thank you. Thank you for doing that. And please, like, we love getting episode suggestions because sometimes we're like, what the fuck do we talk about?
I know. There are some weeks that we end up feeling stuck. So it's good to have those kind of like in our back pocket that
totally.
We can look at and reach out to. So if you would like to follow us on Instagram, please do so at Angry Neighborhood Feminist. You can also follow us on Twitter. Again, I feel guilty mentioning this because I don't update our Twitter as much as I should. But if you want to, if that's what you like to use, you can follow us on Twitter at YANF Podcast,
YANF
Podcast. We also have a Facebook business and group page. Feel free to leave us a review on our business page.
Mm-hmm.
You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Yes.
We love getting new reviews there.
We do, and I'm going to mention because I think I forgot to mention it in the news episode. I went into our reviews, as you know, yesterday, and there was somebody who had mentioned us talking over each other and, you know, sound quality. Sometimes our sound quality has not always been the best, and when it comes to us talking over each other, one, that's just kind of how we converse. I'm sorry if that causes anxiety, as this one reviewer said, but also sometimes it's hard to get your point in. You gotta jump in, gotta find your way, and we are aware that this is something that we do, and we are going to try our best to minimize that.
Yes, absolutely.
So work with us. We do the best we can.
Yes.
That's all I have to say on that matter.
Okay. So we do love getting your reviews. So
do
feel free to leave us reviews there on Apple Podcasts. You can also listen to us on Radio Public. It's free for you. It helps us a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that is everything.
It is, you guys. So with all of that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Bye.